Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves, presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp for your chance to win a $200 tattered cover gift certificate. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute. It's time to begin.
Welcome to the Tattered Cover, and good evening. I'd like to thank you for supporting your local independent booksellers. Tonight, we are pleased to have David Eagleman with us. David is a neuroscientist with the Baylor College of Medicine, where he runs the Lab for Perception and Action, focusing on synesthesia, neurolaw, and on the perception of time. Synesthesia is an unusual perceptual condition in which the simulation of one sense triggers an involuntary sensation in another sense. Neurolaw examines how we understand neurology should influence how we punish and rehabilitate criminals, as well as how to make new laws. David is the co-author of a book about synesthesia, Wednesday is Indigo Blue, due out sometime this spring. And I believe, if I did my research correctly, has two other books set for due out maybe next year at some point. Tonight, David will be presenting and signing his first work of fiction, Sum. Sum is a collection of 40 stories all looking at different ideas about the afterlives. Please join me in a warm welcome for David Eagleman.
Chuck, and thank you guys for being here. It's a real pleasure to see a bunch of friendly faces here. For those of you who haven't read it, Sum is a collection of 40 short stories. Turns out they're not really about the afterlife. Instead, it's a collection of literary fiction that gives angles on human nature and on our own lives and appreciating what's going on here with those lives. And They're meant to be humorous and thought-provoking lenses into understanding what we're doing here. So what I propose in there are many different versions of what might be going on, and none of the versions are meant to be taken seriously. The only serious part is the exercise of exploring different sorts of options. So in some of the stories, God is a married couple who's getting divorced. In other stories, God is the size of a microbe and doesn't know that we exist because we're on the wrong spatial scale. In some the afterlife is run by a committee and things are falling apart. In others, God doesn't exist at all. And in the afterlife, people are battling over their different versions of his non-existence. In others, we are mobile rovers for exploring planetary cartography. And it turns out that the creators are disappointed that all we do, instead of looking at planetary data, we all just end up looking at each other all the time. In others, when the universe stops expanding and begins to contract, the arrow of time flips, and we get to live our lives backwards, and we discover all the ways in which we misremember the details of our own lives. So these are the types of stories that we have in some. And it came out exactly 3 weeks ago, and it's been a heck of a ride so far, because my publishers had hoped that this would be a sleeper hit, where it would spread by word of mouth, and we were very gratified and humbled to find out that within the first 7 days, it hit number 39 on Amazon, and nobody was expecting that, and it got a full-page coverage in Wall Street Journal and got named Book of the Week by The Week magazine and so on. So what I want to do a little bit is talk about why I think that might have happened, why I think the book is catching on, and I also want to talk about what the ideas are that lie underneath the stories. So as far as why it's enjoying whatever little success it's having, I think there are two main reasons. One of them is, and to me this is one of the biggest compliments about the book, is that nobody knows how to classify it. And people who have written about it so far have said, There's really not another book that's like this. And that is the, I think that quality of it held it back a little bit from publication at the beginning. It was hard to get agents to know exactly what to do with it. But once it got through the phalanx of agents and into the publishing world, I think it's that same quality that held it back is what is spring-loaded it for wherever it's going now, that unique quality too. The second issue is the set of ideas behind it. But before I tell you about that, what I want to do is read you some of the stories. So I'm going to read three or four of the stories to you, and if anybody has any special requests, I can be like a DJ and take those. So I'll start with the title story, Some. In the afterlife, you relive all your experiences, but this time with the events reshuffled into a new order. All the moments that share a quality are grouped together. You spend 2 months driving the street in front of your house, 7 months having sex. You sleep for 30 years without opening your eyes. For 5 months straight, you flip through magazines while sitting on a toilet. You take all your pain at once, all 27 intense hours of it. Bones break, cars crash, skin is cut, babies are born. Once you make it through, it's agony-free for the rest of your afterlife. But that doesn't mean it's always pleasant. You spend 6 days clipping your nails, 15 months looking for lost items, 18 months waiting in line, 2 years of boredom, staring out a bus window, sitting in an airport terminal, 1 year reading books. Your eyes hurt and you itch because you can't take a shower until it's your time to take your marathon 200-day shower. 2 weeks wondering what happens when you die. 1 minute realizing your body is falling. 77 hours of confusion. 1 hour realizing you've forgotten someone's name. 3 weeks realizing you are wrong. 2 days lying. 6 weeks waiting for a green light. 7 hours vomiting. 14 minutes experiencing pure joy. 3 months doing laundry. 15 hours writing your signature. 2 days tying shoelaces. 67 days of heartbreak. 5 weeks driving lost. 3 days calculating restaurant tips. 51 days deciding what to wear. 9 days pretending you know what is being talked about. 2 weeks counting money. 18 days staring into the refrigerator. 34 days longing. 6 months watching commercials. 4 weeks sitting in thought, wondering if there is something better you could be doing with your time. 3 years swallowing food. 5 days working buttons and zippers. 4 minutes wondering what your life would be like if you reshuffled the order of events. In this part of the afterlife, you imagine something analogous to your earthly life, and the thought is blissful. A life where episodes are split into tiny, swallowable pieces, where moments do not endure, where one experiences the joy of jumping from one event to the next, like a child hopping from spot to spot on the burning sand. The next story I'd like to read is called Prism. God resolved at the outset that he wanted every human to participate in the afterlife. But the plans weren't thought out to completion, and immediately he began to run up against some confusion about age. How old should each person be in the afterlife? Should this grandmother exist here at her age of death? Or should she be allowed to live as a young woman, recognizable to her first lover, but not to her granddaughter? He decided it was unfair to keep people the age they were at the end of their lives, when much of their beauty and alacrity had been worn down. Allowing everyone to live as a young adult proved an unviable solution, because the afterlife quickly degenerated into unbounded sexual pursuits. And at middle ages, they talked only about their children and mortgages, making conversations in the afterlife tedious. God finally landed on an ingenious solution, while watching light diffract through a prism. So when you arrive here, you are split into your multiple selves at all possible ages. The you that existed as a single identity is now all ages at once. These pieces of you no longer get older, but remain ageless into perpetuity. The yous have transcended time. This takes some getting used to. The different beams of you might run into each other at the grocery store, like separate people do on Earth life. Your 76-year-old self may revisit his favorite creek and run into your 11-year-old self. Your 28-year-old self may break up with a lover in a diner and notice your 35-year-old self visiting that spot, lingering on the air of regret hanging over the empty seat. Typically, the different yous are happy to see each other because they possess the same name and a shared history. But the yous are more critical of yourselves than they are of others, and so each of you quickly identifies habits that get under your skin. It's a fact of the afterlife. Don't be surprised to discover that after decomposition into your different ages, the different yous tend to drift apart. You discover that the you of 8 years old has less in common than expected with the you of 32 and the you of 64. The 18-year-old you finds more in common with other 18-year-olds than with your 73-year-old you. The 73-year-old you doesn't mind a bit, seeking out meaningful conversations with others of the same generation. Beyond the name, the yous have little else in common. But don't lose hope. The shared resume of life, parents, birthplace, hometown, school years, first kiss, has a magnetic, nostalgic pull. So once in a while, the different yous organize a gathering, like a family reunion, bringing together all your ages into a single room. At these reunions, the middle age will delightedly pinch the cheeks of the young, and the teenagers will politely listen to the stories and advice of the elderly. These reunions reveal a group of individuals touchingly searching for a common theme. They appeal to your name as a unifying structure, but they come to realize that the name that existed on Earth, the you that moved serially through these different identities, was like a bundle of sticks from different trees. They come to understand, with awe, the complexity of the compound identity that existed on the Earth. They conclude, with a shudder, that the earthly you is utterly lost, unpreserved in the afterlife. You were all these ages, they concede, and you were none. Actually, I think I'll try Ineffable. When soldiers part ways at the war's end, the breakup of the platoon triggers the same emotion as the death of a person. It is the final, bloodless death of the war. The same mood haunts actors on the drop of the final curtain. After months of working together, something greater than themselves has just died. After a store closes its doors on its final evening, or a Congress wraps its final session, the participants amble away, feeling that they were part of something larger than themselves, something they intuit had a life, even though they can't quite put a finger on it. In this way, death is not only for humans, but for everything that existed. And it turns out that anything which enjoys life enjoys an afterlife. Platoons and plays and stores and congresses do not end, they simply move on to a different dimension. They are things that were created and existed for a time, and therefore, by the cosmic rules, they continue to exist in a different realm. Although it is difficult for us to imagine how these beings interact, they enjoy a delicious afterlife together, exchanging stories of their adventures. They laugh about good times and often, just like humans, lament the brevity of life. The people who constituted them are not included in their stories. In truth, they have as little understanding of you as you have of them. They generally have no idea that you existed. It may seem mysterious to you that these organizations can live on without the people who composed them. But the underlying principle is simple. The afterlife is made of spirits. After all, you do not bring your kidney and liver and heart to the afterlife with you. Instead, you gain independence from the pieces that made you up. A consequence of this cosmic scheme may surprise you. When you die, you are grieved by all the atoms of which you are composed. They hung together for years, whether in sheets of skin or communities of spleen. With your death, they do not die. Instead, they part ways, moving off in their separate directions, mourning the loss of a special time they shared together, haunted by the feeling that they were once playing parts in something larger than themselves, something that had its own life, something they can hardly put a finger on.
your inspiration?
Thank you for asking. Some took me 9 years to write. It turns out it's actually hard to write a shorter book than it is to write a longer book. And so this was a collection of little pieces of inspiration over the course of 9 years, and then a lot of polishing of those. And it came from anywhere. An idea that would come to me, or a snatch of dialogue I made here, or some concept. And one thing that maybe will become clear with a few of these stories is... when you look at particular stories about something like the afterlife, which is something we have, of course, zero data to weigh in on, we know nothing about any of this, right? When you look at the stories, there's always a little bit of goofiness in the stories. For example, this problem about age. So whenever I started looking at other stories, I would think about what the consequences were, and that provided a lot of the inspiration, just sort of springboarding off the things that were already, that people were already discussing. I'm just gonna read half of one more. For my new friend David Grinspoon, who is an astrobiologist, I want to read the story where in the afterlife you end up in this great padded compound where everything is soft. Everything is made of feathers. You can't make any loud noises there. Everything is soft. And you meet a big person there who you assume is God, and he corrects you and says, actually, I'm not God. I'm your planetary neighbor from a neighboring star system, and he explains to you the mess that is going on there. And he says that the Earthlings are making a lot of noise, and they're sort of they're sort of geared up for expansionism into the galaxy. And you say, that's the mess? Is that we're in expansionism? And he says, that's not the mess. Allow me to illustrate the larger picture. He speaks very quietly, by the way. Everything is whispered there. Let me illustrate the larger picture. You and I, our planets, our galaxy, we're part of what you should think of as an immeasurable living mass. You might call it a giantess, but summarizing the concept in a word might give you the illusion that you can have a hint of a notion of her enormity. To give you a sense of scale, you are the size of an atom for her. You are Earth, sprouting with its untold layers of furiously fecund species. Your Earth is tantamount to a single protein in the shadowy depths of a single one of her cells. Our Milky Way constitutes a single cell, but a small one. She consists of hundreds of billions of such cells. For millions of years, my people had no notion of her, just as a flatworm is unlikely to discover that the planet is round. A colony of bacteria will never know the walls of the flask. A single cell in your hand will not know that it is contributing to a concerto on the piano. But with advancing philosophy and technology, we came to appreciate our situation. Then, a few millennia ago, it was theorized that we might be able to communicate with her. It was proposed that we might decipher her structure, deploy signals, influence her behavior in the manner that infinitesimal molecules, hormones, alcohol, narcotics, can influence a creature like you. So we organized and educated ourselves. Instead of fretting through the doomed, ignoble cycles of local politics, we dedicated our economy and sciences towards understanding the biochemistry of universal scales. We methodically mapped out the signaling cascades and stellar anatomy of her nervous system, and at last discovered how to transmit a signal to her consciousness. We sent a sharply defined sequence of electromagnetic pulses, which interacted with local magnetospheres, which influenced asteroid orbits, which nudged planets closer and farther from stars, which dictated the fate of life forms, which changed the gases in the atmospheres, which bent the path of light signals, all in complex interacting cascade, which we had worked out. Our calculations told us that it took a few hundred years for the transmission to arrive at her consciousness. At the time of the arrival, I was sad to be traveling away from the planet while everyone was so excited to see what would happen. His face twitches with painful trickles of reminiscence. But no one would have guessed what happened next. A great sheet of meteors rained down. Incendiary hydrogen clouds crushed in, and these were followed by a multitude of black holes that mercilessly swallowed up the flying chunks and dust and the last light of remembrance. No one survived. In all probability, this was neutral to her. It might have been an immune system response, or she might have been scratching an itch, or sneezing, or getting a biopsy. So we discovered that we can communicate with her, but we cannot communicate meaningfully. We are of insufficient size. What can we say to her? What question could we ask? How could she communicate an answer back to us? Perhaps that was her attempt to answer. What could you ask her to do that would have relevance to your life? And if she told you what was of importance to her, could you understand her answer? Do you think it would have any meaning at all if you displayed one of your Shakespearean plays to a bacterium? Of course not. Meaning varies with spatial scale. So we have concluded that communicating with her is not impossible, but it is pointless. And that is why we are now hunkered down silently on the surface of this noiseless planet, whispering through a slow orbit, trying not to draw attention to ourselves. Thank you. If there, yes. That's an interesting question. All of these afterlives, by the way, are meant as completely improbable jokes, so it's hard to pick one that I would want to be a part of, maybe. Well, I don't know. Let me come back to that question, because this is a good segue to what the point of the book is, so I'm glad you asked that. So here's the thing. So I've spent my entire adult life in science. That's what I do. And science is the most incredible tool that we have. It's allowed us to, to study the blueprints of what's actually going on around us instead of making up stories. We're constantly knocking down our own walls and really trying to figure out what's going on around us. And as a result, we've been able to wipe out smallpox and polio and build the internet and get ships to the moon and do all kinds of incredible things. So we're always making forward progress here. And what happens in each generation is we get a little bit further down the pier of science, and we're able to see a little bit further than we were able to before. The issue, though, is that when you spend your life in science and you get to the end of the pier, you realize that beyond the end of that is everything else. And essentially, it's uncharted waters as far as the eye can see. So that leaves us in a situation where what you really get from a life in science is an appreciation of the vastness of our ignorance and all the things that we don't know, right? So my scientific colleagues like Dawkins and Dennett and Harris, these guys have become, you may be familiar with their book, they've written a series of books and they're known as the New Atheists, and they, I think, appropriately criticize many of the stories that people buy into simply because their parents and their culture tells them that that's the truth. So people believe fervently in these stories. But of course, everybody of every other religion, and there are 2,000 of them, they believe equally as fervently in their own version of the story, and they think your version is ridiculous. So there are problems there with religion. So these guys have written brilliant and incisive books. The problem is, the way their books have come off, I'm afraid, they seem to have thrown out all the interesting stuff with the bathwater. And what they leave you with is this sense from the book that we sort of know everything and it's all understood and it's all pinned down by modern science, and that's simply not true. So does that make me a religious person? No, because at the other end of the scale are all these problems that the new atheists have correctly pointed out. I mean, there are real problems here. And as Dawkins puts it, everybody knows what it's like to be an atheist, because all you have to do is look at somebody else's religion, and you know that that's patently ridiculous that they could believe in that, and they think the same of yours, right? So we already know what that's like. So that puts me somewhere in the middle. So some people for that use the term agnostic, but I find that a weak term, because people typically mean by that, I don't know whether the guy with the beard on the cloud exists or doesn't exist. You know, the story that my parents taught me, maybe it's true, maybe it's not true. That's often what's meant by agnostic. So I proposed a new term, and I was on NPR twice this past week, and I proposed the term possibilian. And the idea with being a possibilian is being open to multiple hypotheses and, you know, in science, we're always looking for the weight of the evidence, what hypothesis is ported over another. But it turns out that there are a lot of problems in science that we don't even have the tools to get evidence for. They're beyond the ken of science. And so as a result, we have to hold multiple hypotheses in our head. Well, this is what scientists are really good at. Scientists have this temperament of creativity and tolerance for multiple ideas and saying, okay, well, maybe that's true, and maybe that's true, and maybe that's true, and I can make up 40 other things that might be true, and until there's any reason to privilege one story over another, then I'm comfortable holding all these in my head at the same time. So that's the idea with possibilianism, is celebrating the vastness of our ignorance and the number of possibilities out there. And so this book is all about shining a flashlight around that possibility space. None of the stories are meant to be taken seriously, but what is serious is the exercise of exploring the multitude of points in that space. So ever since I proposed possibilianism about a week and a half ago, I've gotten hundreds of emails from people telling me that they too are possibilians and they want to be part of the movement. And really, there is no movement because we wouldn't know what to do with ourselves. I did set up possibilian.com, and like many pages on the internet, there's really nothing useful on the page, but I wanted to make sure I got it. So the interesting part is I feel like I've kind of, you know, it's not for everybody. Some people want to be hardcore atheists, and some people want to be hardcore religious types and believe a particular version of their story. And that's great. Both of those are points in that possibility space. But it appears that I've accidentally hit on something that a lot of people are interested in, this idea that you don't have to throw everything out and you don't have to buy into a particular idiosyncratic story, but instead you can be interested in exploring the size of the possibility space. So I've gotten lots of emails from people who want to be possibilians. I've also gotten a many fewer number of emails, but angry emails from both very religious types and skeptical literalists. And as my friend David said today, if you're getting angry emails from both ends of the spectrum who are normally at war with each other, then that probably means you've written a pretty good book. So I'm happy about that. So that's the set of ideas that lies underneath these 40 humorous stories. There's a question in the back here.
Well, David, this is fabulous, and thank you for inspiring us to think more broadly. And I'm looking forward to the beer conversation of discussing in what ways science isn't a human construction any more than religion is. So that's going to be, or you can answer
sure.
That now. But let me sort of backtrack a moment and say, I find the stories that I've read in your book so far quite optimistic, and generally looking at our present condition in a very positive light. This is reminding us that we ought to look positively on where we're at now and how we engage. Are there episodes within this that I haven't reached, or do you have thoughts on perhaps to put in an equally optimistic framing of a constructive criticism of how humans engage?
Thank you for that question. I'm actually a little bit surprised because, okay, so I'm a very optimistic person, but some of the stories are kind of grim in some sense. And so I'm glad that you came away with an optimistic feeling of something. Actually, I'll read one it's not meant to be grim, but it's I think it's interesting. I'll read this one and then we'll talk about that. It's called Circle of Friends. When you die, you feel as though there was some subtle change, but everything looks approximately the same. You get up and brush your teeth. You kiss your spouse and kids and leave for the office. There's less traffic than normal. The rest of your building seems less full, as though it's a holiday. But everyone in your office is here, and they greet you kindly. You feel strangely popular. Everyone you run into is someone you know. At some point, it dawns on you that this is the afterlife. The world is only made up of people you've met before. It's a small fraction of the world population, about 0.0002%. But it seems like plenty to you. It turns out that only the people you remember are here. So the woman with whom you shared a glance in the elevator may or may not be included. Your second grade teacher is here with most of the class. Your parents, your cousins, and your spectrum of friends through the years. All your old lovers. Your boss, your grandmothers, all the waitresses who served your food. Those you dated, those you almost dated, those you longed for. It's a blissful opportunity to spend quality time with your 1,000 connections, to renew fading ties, to catch up with those you let slip away. It is only after several weeks of this that you begin to feel forlorn. You wonder what's different as you saunter through the vast quiet parks with a friend or two. No strangers grace the empty park benches. No family unknown to you throws breadcrumbs for the ducks and makes you smile because of their laughter. As you step into the street, you note there are no crowds, no buildings teeming with workers, no distant cities bustling, no hospitals running 24/7 with patients dying and staff rushing, no trains howling into the night with sardined passengers on their way home. Very few foreigners. You begin to consider all the things unfamiliar to you. You've never known, you realize, how to vulcanize rubber to make a tire. And now those factories stand empty. You've never known how to fashion a silicon chip from beach sand, how to launch rockets out of the atmosphere, how to pit olives or lay railroad tracks. And now those industries are shut down. The missing crowds make you lonely. You begin to complain about all the people you could be meeting, but no one listens or sympathizes with you because this is precisely what you chose when you were alive.
I still think that's optimistic.
Okay.
Not to say the afterworld is optimistic, but rather to point out in our circumstance there are all these great things that we don't appreciate now.
Yeah.
In our life, and that it's a constant reminder to say, wait a sec, this level of anonymity, this level of possibility in our own space is extraordinarily important in our lives.
Yeah, that's right. Well, thank you. I like that. I like that interpretation of the book. Was there a question?
Looking back the other direction, would you read the story about the ancient gods?
Oh, yeah, okay. This story is called Graveyard of the Gods. Graveyard of the Gods. Because the afterlife is a form of justice, we may think that it cannot include animals who are not held responsible for their actions. Thankfully, we would be wrong. It would have been a lonely afterlife without animals, and we have discovered the pleasant truth that the hereafter is full of dogs, mosquitoes, kangaroos, and every other creature. After you arrive and look around for a while, it becomes obvious that anything that once existed enjoys a continued existence. You begin to realize that the gift of immortality applies to things we created as well. The afterlife is full of cell phones, mugs, porcelain knickknacks, business cards, candlesticks, dartboards. Even things that were destroyed, cannibalized naval ships, retired computers, demolished cabinetry, all return in full form to furnish the hereafter. Contrary to the admonition that we cannot take it with us, anything we create becomes part of our afterlife. If it was created, it survives. Surprisingly, this rule applies to creations not only material but also mental. So along with the creations that join us in the afterlife are the gods we created. Lonely in a coffee shop, you might meet Reshef, the Semitic god of plague and war. The head of a gazelle grows from his forehead. He gazes wistfully out the window at passerby. In the grocery store aisle, you may bump into the Babylonian death god Nergal, the Greek Apollo, or the Vedic Rudra. In the shopping mall, you'll spot gods of flames and moons, goddesses of sexual acts and fertility, gods of fallen war horses and runaway slaves. Despite their incognito clothing, they are typically detected by their gargantuan size and such characteristics as lion heads, multiple arms, or reptilian tails. They are lonely. In large part because they've lost their audiences. They used to cure disease, act as intermediaries between the living and dead, and dole out crops and protection and revenge for the loyal. Now, no one knows their names. They never asked to be born, yet they find themselves ensnared here for eternity. Only rarely is there a local resurgence of belief in an old god, a small clumping of fans, but such bursts are always short-lived. The gods recognize that they are stuck here with their dealt hand of cards, a vengeful personality, fire for eyes, dysfunctional kin, and eternity on their hands. When you begin to look around, you'll discover thousands of them. The Aztec Mictucahani, the Chinese monkey king Sun Wukong, the Norse Odin. In the afterlife phone books, you can find the rainbow serpent of the Aboriginal Australians, the Prussian Zempot, the Wendish Burstuck, the Algonquin Gichimantu, the Sardinian Maimon, the Thracian Zibilthurtos. At a restaurant, you might eavesdrop on the still-cold relationship between the Babylonian sea goddess Tiamat and the storm god Marduk, who once split her in two. She picks at her food and only gives curt replies to his attempts at conversation. Some of the gods are related to one another. Others have untraceable genealogies. What they have in common is a proclivity to refuse the free housing offered in the afterlife, although no one is sure why. Most likely it is because they are having a difficult time coming to terms with the idea of sinking to the level of their one-time genuflectors. Instead, at night, lonely and homeless, they cluster in one another's company on the far edge of the city, lying down to sleep in large grassy meadows. If you're interested in history and theology, you'll enjoy walking these fields of gods, this quiet horizontal spectacle of abandoned deities laid in uneven rows to the vanishing point. Here you might run across Bathalang Mayaktal of the Tagalogs, and his main enemy, the lizard god Bacchanawa. Having no one who cares about their fights anymore, they now share a lonely bottle of wine. Here you see the god of light, Atea, from the Tuamotu archipelago, and his son, Tain, who in his heyday hurled the patricidal lightning bolts of his ancestor. Now, the whole family sits around, their vendettas withered and difficult to reinvigorate. Look, here's the Maori Tawarhimata, the god of storms and winds, who spent his lifetime punishing his brother deities for separating his parents. With no more audience, his winds are spent, and he plays cards with his brothers under calm skies. Here's the Shinto fire god, Kagutuchi, whose birth burned his mother to death. Now the only evidence of his former blaze is a light smoky smell. Like a museum, these fields of gods, this pastoral encyclopedia of mythology, is a testament to human creativity and reification. The old gods are used to watching us here. The new gods are stung by how quickly they slipped from reverence and martyrdom to desertion and tourism. Although the gods choose to congregate together out here, the truth is that they cannot stand one another. They are confused because they have found themselves here in the afterlife, but they still, deep down, believe they are in charge. They have typically risen to the top because of their aggression, and they still want to claim supremacy over the others. But here they no longer enjoy the peak of a hierarchy. Instead, they suffer side by side in a fellowship of abandonment. There's only one thing they appreciate about this afterlife. Because of their famed vengefulness and creativity in the arts of torture, they find themselves impressed by this version of hell.
Okay, that's not optimistic.
I got 1 out of 40. Okay. Did I see another hand here? Well, that's a good question. It turns out we have no evidence that weighs in on that one way or another. We just don't know. It may be that you go to sleep and it's like that forever. Maybe that one of these 40 things happens, although I'm not sure whether that'd be good or bad. And it may be that there are millions of other possibilities. It turns out we just have no way of favoring any one story over any other story. Yes?
I thought the question he was asking was slightly different than the one you answered.
Okay. What was?
Even if it wasn't, I want you to answer it now, which is, what happens if you're in one of these afterlives and then you die?
Well.
Yeah, that's what he meant.
Well, I'm glad you asked, Joshua, because there are at least two stories where that happens. Here, I'll quickly read. These are all short enough and bite sized that I can answer questions with stories. Metamorphosis. There are three deaths. The first is when the body ceases to function. The second is when the body is consigned to the grave. The third is that moment, sometime in the future, when your name is spoken for the last time. So you wait in this lobby until the third death. There are long tables with coffee, tea, and cookies. You can help yourself. There are people here from all around the world, and with just a little effort, you can strike up convivial small talk. Just be aware that your conversation may be interrupted at any moment by the callers, who broadcast your new friend's name to indicate that there will never again be another remembrance of him by anyone on the earth. Your friend slumps, face like a shattered and re-glued plate, saddened even though the callers tell him kindly that he's off to a better place. No one knows where that better place is or what it offers because no one exiting through that door has returned to tell us. Tragically, many people leave just as their loved ones arrive, since the loved ones were the only ones doing the remembering. We all wag our heads at that typical timing. The whole place looks like an infinite airport waiting area. There are many famous people here from the history books. If you get bored, you can strike out in any given direction past aisles and aisles of seats. After many days of walking, you'll start to notice that people look different, and you'll hear the tones of foreign languages. People congregate among their own kind, and one sees the spontaneous emergence of territories that mirror the pattern on the surface of the planet. With the exception of the oceans, you're traversing a map of the Earth. There are no time zones here. No one sleeps, even though they mostly wish they could. The place is evenly lit by fluorescent lights. Not everyone is sad when the callers enter the room and shout out the list of names. On the contrary, some people beg and plead, prostrating themselves at the caller's feet. These are generally the folks that have been here a long time, too long. Especially those who are remembered for unfair reasons. For example, take the farmer over there, who drowned in a small river 200 years ago. Now his farm is the site of a small college, and the tour guides each week tell his story. So he's stuck, and he's miserable. The more his story is told, the more the details drift. He is utterly alienated from his name. It is no longer identical with him, but continues to bind. The cheerless woman across the way is praised as a saint, even though the roads in her heart were complicated. The gray-haired man at the vending machine was lionized as a war hero, then demonized as a warlord, and finally canonized as a necessary firebrand between two moments in history. He waits with aching heart for his statues to fall. And that is the curse of this room. Since we live in the heads of those who remember us, we lose control of our lives and become who they want us to be. Other questions? Okay, thank you guys very much, and I'll be here to sign the books if you want.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we've been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp for your chance to win a $200 Tattered Cover gift certificate and learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.